Let us begin our lesson by stepping back in time, just for a moment, to think about a very old problem that humans have always faced. How do you protect something valuable from people who want to take it or destroy it? Thousands of years ago, a city in ancient Mesopotamia solved this problem by building thick walls around itself. But the builders quickly realized that walls alone were not enough. You needed gates and someone to watch those gates. You needed guards walking the walls, looking for anything unusual. And if your king needed to send a secret message to a trusted ally in a distant city, he needed a messenger who could travel safely without the message being read by enemies. The wall, the guards, and the secret messenger each did a different job. Together, they made the city much harder to attack. Today, the networks that carry our data face exactly the same challenge. The tools have changed dramatically. The internet is not a dusty road through a desert. Data is not a scroll carried by a horseman. But the fundamental logic of protection is the same. You need walls. You need guards. And you need a secret tunnel for trusted communications. In the language of network security, these tools are called a firewall, an IDs or IPs, and a VPN. This lesson will explain all three in careful detail, show you how they work, and help you understand how they work together to keep a network safe. Before we go further, we need to understand one foundational idea that connects everything in this lesson. That idea is called defense in depth. This simply means that you should never rely on just one layer of protection. If that one layer fails, your entire system is exposed. By layering multiple defenses, you force an attacker to break through several barriers instead of just one. Each layer you add makes the attacker's job harder and gives you more chances to detect and stop them. Keep this idea in mind throughout the lesson. It is the reason all three of our tools exist together and not as replacements for each other. Let us begin with the most fundamental of the three tools, the firewall. Imagine you are the mayor of a walled medieval city. Every day, hundreds of travelers arrive at your gate. Some are merchants bringing goods you need. Some are messengers carrying important letters. But among them, hidden in cloaks, might be spies or soldiers working for an enemy kingdom. You cannot let everyone in without checking them. So you place a gatekeeper at the gate with a rulebook. The rulebook says things like, merchants carrying wheat may enter through the east gate. Messengers from the king's allies are allowed. Anyone carrying a weapon and arriving from the northern road after dark must be turned away. A firewall works in almost exactly this way. A firewall is a security device, which can be a piece of physical hardware or a software program, that sits at the boundary between two networks. One network is trusted, like your company's internal computers and servers. The other network is untrusted, like the open internet. Every piece of data that tries to move between these two networks must first pass through the firewall and be checked against its rulebook. The rulebook in firewall language is called a set of security rules or policies. To understand how the firewall reads data, you first need to understand what a packet is. When you send information across a network, whether it is an email, a web page, a video, or anything else, that information is broken up into small, manageable pieces called packets. Think of it like mailing a long book by cutting it into chapters and sending each chapter in a separate envelope. Each envelope has a label on the outside showing where it came from and where it is going. The firewall looks at these labels and decides whether to let each envelope through. The label on a data packet contains several important pieces of information. The first is the IP address, which is a unique numerical identifier given to every device on a network, much like a postal address for your house. The packet's label shows the source IP address, meaning where it came from, and the destination IP address, meaning where it is going. The second piece of information is the port number. A port is not a physical socket. It is a numbered channel that a computer uses for a specific type of communication. For example, when your browser loads a website, it almost always uses port 80 for standard web traffic, which is called HTTP, or port 443 for secure web traffic, called HTTPS. When your email client sends a message, it typically uses port 25, a channel called SMTP, the firewall can see which port is being used and decide whether that type of communication is allowed. The third piece of information is the protocol, which is essentially the language or method being used to send the data. Common protocols include TCP, which ensures reliable delivery, and UDP, which is faster but less reliable. So a basic firewall rule might look like this. Allow all traffic coming from any source and going to port 443, because that is normal web browsing. Block all traffic trying to connect to port 23, which is Telnet, an old and insecure remote access method, because we do not want anyone using that. This kind of simple rule-based checking describes the earliest type of firewall, known as a stateless firewall or packet filtering firewall. The word stateless means that this firewall has no memory. It checks each packet completely on its own, without knowing anything about what came before it. This is like a gatekeeper who checks each person at the gate, but immediately forgets them after they pass through. The first firewalls of this kind were described by engineers at a company called Digital Equipment Corporation in the late 1980s. While stateless firewalls were an important first step, they had a serious weakness. Because they had no memory, they could be fooled. An attacker could craft a packet that looked, on the outside, like a legitimate response to a request, even if no such request had ever been made. The firewall would see the label, check its rules, and let it through without suspecting anything was wrong. The next generation of firewalls solved this problem by adding memory. These are called stateful inspection firewalls. The word stateful simply means that the firewall remembers the state, or current status, of active network connections. A firewall of this type keeps a table, like a ledger or a guest list, of all the connections that have been established. If a computer inside the network makes a request to a website, the firewall writes this down. When the website's response arrives from outside, the firewall checks its ledger. It sees that yes, a request was made, and therefore this response is expected and legitimate. It allows the response through. But if a packet arrives from outside that claims to be a response, and there is no matching request in the ledger, the firewall blocks it because it knows something suspicious is happening. This was a major leap forward in security, and stateful inspection was pioneered by a company called Checkpoint Software Technologies in the early 1990s. Think of a stateful firewall like a hotel reception desk. When a guest checks in, the receptionist writes their name and room number in a book. Later, when someone calls the front desk asking to be connected to room 214, the receptionist checks the book. If there is a guest in room 214, the call is connected. If no one has checked into room 214, the call is rejected. The receptionist does not just check the caller in isolation. They check it against the context of what they already know. As the internet grew and became more complex, even stateful firewalls were not enough. Attackers became more creative. They began hiding malicious activity inside traffic that looked perfectly normal. For example, a piece of malware might communicate with its controller over port 443, the same port used for legitimate secure web traffic. A stateful firewall, looking only at the packet's label, would see traffic on port 443 and assume it was normal web browsing. It would let it through. This led to the development of next-generation firewalls, often called NGFW. These are the modern standard. An NGFW includes all the features of a stateful firewall but adds a powerful new capability called Deep Packet Inspection, or DPI. Instead of just reading the label on the outside of the envelope, Deep Packet Inspection opens the envelope and reads the letter inside. This allows the firewall to look at the actual content of the data, not just where it is coming from and going to. A closely related feature of NGFW is application awareness. This means the firewall can identify which specific application is generating the traffic, regardless of which port it uses. Here is a concrete example of why this matters. A company wants to stop employees from using BitTorrent, a file-sharing program, because it can be used to download illegal files and consumes a lot of bandwidth. An older firewall might try to block the specific port numbers that BitTorrent typically uses. but modern BitTorrent software is clever. It can switch to any available port, a trick sometimes called port hopping. An NGFW with application awareness watches the pattern and content of the traffic itself. BitTorrent data has a unique fingerprint in how it is structured and how it behaves. The NGFW recognizes this fingerprint and blocks the traffic no matter which port it is pretending to use, because it knows what the traffic really is. Now let us move on to our second tool, which operates at a different level of the defense system altogether. Even the best firewall has a limitation. It is primarily designed to enforce access rules at the boundary of your network. It is very good at stopping unwanted visitors at the gate. But what about a visitor who gets through the gate using perfectly valid credentials and then starts causing trouble inside your castle? Or what about a clever attacker who wraps their malicious data inside a type of traffic that the firewall is programmed to allow? This is where intrusion detection systems and intrusion prevention systems come in. We abbreviate these as IDS and IPS respectively. Let us return to our city metaphor. The firewall is your gate and your gatekeeper. But imagine you also have two kinds of guards working inside and along the walls. The first type of guard, your IDS, is an observer. This guard watches everyone who moves through the city streets. If they see something suspicious, like a group of strangers drawing maps of the castle's weak points, they immediately run to the city commander and make a report. The guard does not intervene directly. They detect and report. The second type of guard, your IPS, is an intervener. This guard is positioned at a choke point, a narrow alley that everyone must pass through. When they see suspicious activity, they do not just report it. They step forward and stop it immediately. They might grab the suspicious person, block the alley, or disarm the threat on the spot. This is the core difference between IDS and IPS. An IDS is passive. It monitors network traffic, looking for signs of malicious activity, and when it finds something, it logs the event and sends an alert to a security administrator. It is an early warning system. An IPS is active. It sits directly in the path of network traffic, meaning all traffic flows through it. When it identifies a threat, it takes immediate action, such as dropping the harmful packets, which means deleting them so they never reach their destination, or blocking all traffic from the source of the attack. Both IDS and IPS systems use two main methods to identify threats. The first method is signature-based detection. A signature, in this context, is a unique, recognizable pattern that a specific type of attack always produces in network traffic. Think of it like a criminal's fingerprints. Every time a specific virus or hacking technique is used, it leaves a predictable mark in the data. The IDS or IPS has a large database of these known signatures. It compares every piece of traffic against this database. If a match is found, an alert is raised or the traffic is blocked. To make this concrete, consider a very common type of web attack called an SQL injection. SQL, pronounced SQL, is the language used to communicate with databases. Many websites use databases to store user accounts, product information, and so on. In an SQL injection attack, the attacker types malicious database commands into an ordinary web form, such as a search box or a login field, hoping the website will accidentally pass those commands to its database and execute them. A classic example of malicious SQL injection text is a string-like quote, or 1 equals 1, quote. This is designed to tell the database to return everything it contains, bypassing security checks. Signature-based IDS and IPS systems have this exact string and hundreds of variations of it in their signature databases. The moment this pattern appears in incoming traffic, the system recognizes it and acts. An IDS sends an alert. An IPS drops the packet before it ever reaches the web server. The strength of signature-based detection is its precision. When it identifies a known threat, it is almost always right. There are very few false alarms. The critical weakness, however, is that it is completely blind to attacks it has never seen before. Security professionals call a brand new, previously unknown attack a zero-day attack, because there have been 0 days of warning. No signature exists for it yet. A signature-based system simply does not know what to look for and will let the attack pass through. The second method is anomaly-based detection, and it attempts to solve this problem. Instead of looking for known bad patterns, anomaly-based systems first learn what normal looks like. Over a period of time, the system studies the network and builds a baseline, which is a profile of typical, expected behavior. What is the average amount of data that flows through the network each hour? Which servers usually communicate with which other servers? How many new connections are typically made per minute? Once this baseline is established, the system watches for significant deviations from it. Imagine you manage a small library. You know that on a normal Tuesday, about 50 people visit, most of them stay for an hour, and books are taken from three specific sections. Then one Tuesday, you notice that 300 people have suddenly entered. They are all heading straight for the archive room, and they are each taking 20 books. You have never seen this pattern before. You do not know exactly what is happening, but you know it is not normal, and you investigate. This is precisely how anomaly-based detection works. If a database server that normally makes a handful of outgoing connections per day suddenly starts attempting to connect to 10,000 different external computers in an hour, an anomaly-based IPS will flag this as deeply suspicious, even if the attack type is completely new. This is a powerful ability. However, it comes with a significant drawback. Legitimate but unusual events can trigger false alarms. Perhaps the company is running a legitimate but large software update, or the network team is doing authorized testing. The anomaly detector might scream an alert when nothing is actually wrong. When this happens repeatedly, security teams can suffer from something called alert fatigue. This means they receive so many alerts that they start to become desensitized to them, and might miss a genuine threat buried among the noise. Managing the sensitivity of anomaly-based systems to balance detection power against false alarms is one of the ongoing challenges of network security work. In practice, modern IDS and IPS systems often combine both methods, using signatures for known threats and anomaly detection for potential zero-day attacks, while security teams work continuously to tune the settings and reduce false positives. Now let us turn to our third major tool, which serves a fundamentally different purpose from the first two. The firewall and IDS/IPS are both concerned with controlling and inspecting traffic at the boundaries of your network. But what happens to your data when it must travel across a network you do not control and cannot secure, like the open internet? This is the problem that a VPN, or virtual private network, is designed to solve. Picture this scenario. A medieval king needs to send his most trusted advisor on a journey to a distant ally. The road between the two kingdoms passes through dangerous, bandit-filled territory. The king cannot build walls along the entire road. He cannot station guards everywhere. So instead, he gives the advisor a disguise and a sealed container for the message. Even if the bandits stop the advisor and search their bags, they will find only a locked metal box they cannot open. Inside the box, the message is completely safe. The advisor delivers the box to the ally, who has the key to open it. A VPN works through the same principle. It takes your private data and seals it inside an encrypted tunnel for the journey across the public internet. Encryption is the process of scrambling data using a mathematical key so that it looks like meaningless gibberish to anyone who does not have the corresponding key to unscramble it. Even if a criminal on the same public Wi-Fi network intercepts your data, they will see nothing but an unreadable mess of characters. The technical process behind this is called tunneling. The VPN software takes your original data packet, the actual content you want to send, and wraps it inside a new, outer packet. This outer packet is encrypted. It is addressed to the VPN server at your company or at a VPN service provider. When it arrives at the VPN server, the outer packet is unwrapped, the content is decrypted, and the original data is delivered to its destination. From the perspective of anyone watching the traffic flow across the internet, they can see that data is traveling between your computer and the VPN server, but they cannot read what the data says. A VPN provides three specific security guarantees. The first is confidentiality, which means that your data is kept private and cannot be read by unauthorized people. The second is integrity, which means there is a verification system to confirm that the data has not been altered or tampered with during its journey. If a tampering attempt has been made, the receiving end will detect it and reject the corrupted data. The third is authentication, which means the system verifies the identities of both parties before the tunnel is created. Your computer confirms it is talking to the correct, legitimate VPN server, and the server confirms you are an authorized user. This prevents a type of attack called a man-in-the-middle attack, where a criminal tries to impersonate a trusted server and trick you into connecting to them. There are two main technologies used to build VPN tunnels. The first is called ISEC, which stands for Internet Protocol Security. ISEC is a suite of protocols designed to secure communications at the network layer, meaning it protects all data traveling between two points on a network. It is most commonly used for permanent connections between two entire office networks, which is called a site-to-site VPN. Imagine a company with a headquarters in New York and a branch office in London. A site-to-site VPN using ISEC would create a permanent, always-on encrypted tunnel between these two locations. Employees in London can access files on the New York server just as easily as if they were in the same building, because their data travels through the secure tunnel invisibly. The second technology is SSL/TLS, which stands for Secure Sockets Layer and Transport Layer Security. This is the same technology that secures your banking website when you see the padlock symbol in your browser. SSL/TLS is widely used for remote access VPNs, which are connections made by individual users working from outside the office. An employee working from a coffee shop can install a lightweight VPN application on their laptop, launch it, and within seconds establish an encrypted tunnel to their company's network. This means their work data is protected even while it travels over the coffee shop's public Wi-Fi, which might be used by dozens of strangers and could potentially be monitored by a criminal. The practical importance of VPNs grew enormously when large numbers of people began working from home and connecting to their company networks over the internet. Without a VPN, sensitive company data, from financial records to personal employee information, would travel across the open internet in a form that could potentially be intercepted and read. Now that we understand all three tools individually, let us watch them work together. This is where the concept of defense in depth becomes truly clear and powerful. Let us follow an employee named Alice. Alice works for a company that keeps very sensitive customer data on its internal servers. Today, Alice is working from a hotel room while traveling for business. She opens her laptop and needs to access a customer file. Alice begins by launching her VPN application. The application contacts the company's VPN server and, after a process of authentication, confirming that Alice is genuinely Alice and that the server is genuinely the company's server, a secure, encrypted tunnel is created. All of Alice's network traffic will now travel through this tunnel. Even if someone at the hotel is monitoring the Wi-Fi network, they will see only encrypted, unreadable data flowing between Alice's laptop and the company's VPN server. This is the first layer of protection. The encrypted tunnel arrives at the company's network boundary, where the firewall is waiting. The firewall has rules that say incoming VPN connections on the appropriate port from authorized users are allowed. It checks the connection, confirms it meets the rules, and passes the traffic through to the VPN concentrator, which is the device that manages VPN connections. The data is then decrypted. This is the second layer, the firewall enforcing access control at the perimeter. Now the decrypted traffic, meaning Alice's actual data requests, flows into the company's internal network, and it must pass through the IPS. This is the third layer. The IPS examines the content of Alice's traffic, looking for any signs of malicious behavior. Here is a scenario where this matters. Suppose that while Alice was at the hotel, she clicked on a link in an email that seemed legitimate but was actually a trap. This installed a piece of malware on her laptop without her knowledge. This malware is now traveling through the VPN tunnel alongside Alice's legitimate work traffic. It looks clean from the outside, because the VPN encrypts everything equally. But once the traffic is decrypted and passes through the IPDES, the IPDES recognizes the malware's signature or detects its unusual behavior. It drops the malicious packets, blocks the malware's activity, and alerts the security team. Alice's legitimate work traffic continues unobstructed, and the server is never exposed to the attack. Without the VPN, Alice's traffic across the hotel Wi-Fi would be exposed. Without the firewall, unauthorized traffic could reach the internal network without scrutiny. Without the IPS, the malware hidden in Alice's traffic would have reached the server. Each layer catches something the other might miss. Before we close, it is important to acknowledge that the world of network security is not static. It is constantly evolving, and experts actively debate the effectiveness and future of these tools. One major ongoing debate is about the changing nature of the network perimeter itself. The entire concept of a firewall is built on the idea that there is a clear boundary between the trusted inside and the untrusted outside of a network. For decades, this was a reasonable model. A company's data lived on servers inside the office, and the firewall sat at the door. But today, companies store their data in cloud services like Amazon Web Services or Microsoft Azure, which live outside the traditional network boundary. Employees might access applications directly through their browsers from anywhere in the world. The idea of a single, well-defined border to protect is becoming increasingly difficult to maintain. This reality has led security thinkers to develop a new philosophy called Zero Trust. Zero Trust is a security model built on the principle that no user, device, or connection should be trusted by default, even if it appears to be coming from inside the company's network. Every request must be continuously verified before access is granted. This represents a significant shift in thinking. Though traditional tools like firewalls and IPS are still part of the picture, a second major challenge is the widespread use of strong encryption. Encryption is excellent for privacy and is essential for protecting data, but it creates a paradox for security tools. If an NGFW uses deep packet inspection to look inside data packets for malicious content, it can only do that if it can read the content. When traffic is encrypted end-to-end, as an increasing proportion of internet traffic now is, the firewall cannot open the envelope and read the letter. It can only see the label. This is sometimes called the going dark problem. Some organizations address this by using a technique where the firewall decrypts the traffic, inspects it for threats, and then re-encrypts it before forwarding it. But this approach raises serious questions about privacy, trust, and the technical complexity of managing cryptographic keys, and it is a subject of ongoing debate among security professionals. There is also a deeply human dimension to all of this that technology alone cannot address. Firewalls, IPS systems, and VPNs are all designed to defend against technical attacks. They are very good at their jobs when it comes to malicious software and hacking techniques, but they provide relatively little protection against an attacker who targets the humans using the network rather than the network itself. If an attacker sends Alice a carefully crafted, convincing email that appears to come from her manager asking her to click a link and enter her VPN username and password, and Alice does so, then the attacker now has valid credentials. When they connect to the VPN with those credentials, the firewall sees a legitimate VPN connection and allows it through. The IPS sees traffic from what appears to be an authorized user and raises no alarm. No technical defense stopped the attack because the attack bypassed the technology entirely by tricking a human. This type of attack is called social engineering or phishing, and it is one of the most effective tools in an attacker's arsenal. This reminds us that technology is only one component of a complete security strategy. Training people to recognize and resist manipulation is equally important. Let us pause now and bring together everything we have covered. A firewall is the gatekeeper at the boundary of your network. It examines every packet of data trying to cross the boundary and decides whether to allow or block it based on rules. Early stateless firewalls checked each packet in isolation. Stateful firewalls improved on this by remembering the context of active connections, so they could tell whether a response was genuinely expected. Modern next-generation firewalls go further still by performing deep packet inspection, looking inside the content of packets, and using application awareness to identify what type of traffic is really flowing, regardless of which port it uses. NIDs, or Intrusion Detection System, is a passive observer that monitors traffic for signs of malicious activity and sends alerts when it finds something suspicious. An IPS, or Intrusion Prevention System, is an active inline system that not only detects threats but immediately blocks them. Both systems use two detection methods. Signature-based detection looks for known attack patterns and is highly accurate but blind to new threats. Anomaly-based detection looks for deviations from normal behavior and can catch new threats but may produce false alarms that lead to alert fatigue. A VPN, or virtual private network, creates a secure, encrypted tunnel for data traveling across an untrusted network like the internet. It provides confidentiality by encrypting data, integrity by verifying data has not been tampered with, and authentication by confirming the identities of both parties. Remote access VPNs allow individual employees to connect securely from anywhere. Site-to-site VPNs permanently connect to entire networks across the internet. Most importantly, these three tools work together as layers of defense. The VPN protects data while it is in transit over untrusted networks. The firewall enforces access control at the network's boundary. The IPS inspects traffic that has been allowed through, looking for hidden threats within apparently legitimate connections. No single layer is sufficient on its own. Together, they embody the principle of defense in depth, making an attacker's job significantly harder at every stage of an attempted intrusion. The field continues to evolve. Cloud computing and remote work are challenging the traditional idea of a fixed network perimeter. Strong encryption creates tensions between privacy and the ability to inspect traffic for threats. And no technical system, however sophisticated, can fully compensate for a human who has been deceived. Understanding these tools, their strengths, their limitations, and the debates surrounding them is the first step toward thinking clearly and critically about how networks can be protected in a complex and changing world.